Hidden Gems, Episode 62, Jason's Shelf of Shame. Welcome to Hidden Gems, a board game podcast where we review unusual, forgotten, and underappreciated board games. We're your hosts. I'm Jason.
I'm Ken.
And this is Bill. Thanks for listening to our show.
We got a new crew here.
We do. Tonight. Yeah. Somebody off the bench. Since Chris has been out of the...
Chris is slacking off.
Absolutely.
So, no, actually, Chris has been really busy, but we fortunately have Ken here with us.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah. So, just to, I guess, kind of set the stage. Mm-hmm. So, I didn't actually even know the title of this episode until I listened to the last one, which I wasn't on. And you guys always throw out, we always throw out the name of the next episode. So, Chris made up the name of this episode, and he called it Jason's Shelf of Shame. But that's basically because he knew that I was going to be running this episode without him. And so... this was my golden opportunity to pull a bunch of games off my shelf.
I always like to call that my shelf of opportunity.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably the better way to put it.
And I will say that all of us had pretty low expectations because, you know, Jason, you know, sometimes what you bring to the table.
No luck, there can be no luck involved, which is actually ironic considering one of the games we're playing tonight. but we'll get to that in a second. But anyway, we got Ken with us here. First time on the show.
First time.
So I'm going to throw it over to you because our tradition whenever we have somebody new on the show is that we let them introduce themselves and kind of hear a little bit about how you got into the hobby and what interests you about board games.
Sure. So. All right. So I'm Ken. You may have seen my name a few times because I've shown up on the Discord a few times as I make comments.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So I think
you're more active on the Discord than I am probably.
I think so. I think so. So I'm old. I'm almost as old as Bill because I'm 51.
Ancient.
Two kids, married 30 years this year, and I work as a performance engineer for cloud storage. That means I try to figure out how fast storage is in the cloud and then make it go faster.
You make the clouds cloudier.
Or less cloudy.
Maybe less cloudy. I try to make it look like it's not in the cloud. So getting into board games, I played board games a lot as a kid. I played the things like Yahtzee and Aggravation and Sorry and Clue and all those sorts of things. College, I started playing a lot of card games. I had a friend teach me how to play Rook. As far as I am concerned, the only right way to play Rook, but apparently it's a way that no one else in the world plays Rook. A Rook is a 10.5. So it's not high and it's not low.
That
it's a 10.5.
That is so weird to me.
I don't know Rook well enough to know why that's weird, but it sounds weird.
Apparently it was a house rule, but as far as I knew, it was the only way to play Rook.
It sounds like two people came to the table. One was adamantly Rook high. Somebody was adamantly Rook low, and they drank enough to say, okay, let's meet in the middle. And such it was born.
It may have been. I can't play the game any other way at this point. But nice. like a lot of people, I think it was Catan that kind of brought me in. I played Catan once, came back and told my wife, hey, this is a fantastic new game. She said, I don't want to play it. It sounds too complex. And then she played it and realized it was a great game and came back and told me about it.
Oh, nice.
And that turned us into Dominion and Carcassonne and Ascension and a whole bunch of stuff like that. And now there's like 500 board games in the house.
Gotcha.
Yes. You walk into Ken's living room and he's got a wall like we're out here in Chris's, you know, room where it happens. So, yeah, very cool.
Catan, the great gateway game for most of us.
You should tell the listeners about your monitoring of the Dice Towers.
So I have an opportunity to go to Dice Tower East this year, and they're running a virtual flea market, which is basically a Board Game Geek list where games are posted for sale. You make a promise to buy them, show up, and then exchange money. Mm-hmm. I like games, and I like deals. So I spent a little time with ChatGPT, got a little help. So now I have an app that runs every 5 minutes and queries Board Game Geek and compares the virtual flea market to my personal wish list and the gem miners list. Mm-hmm. And then another thing that runs every 5 minutes and tells me via Discord if one of those games has been posted with a link to it so I can go off and buy it, which is very, very bad because I'm spending money that I don't need to spend to put things on shelves where I don't have space.
Man after my own heart, though.
I was going to say, you need like a PBS special with a Ken's board game flipper because I think that's what you do is you buy them cheap. And
you do buy and sell a lot.
Mm-hmm. I buy and sell a lot. So we looked the other day. My board game collection is currently free. I'm zero money out for the 500 games that I have because of the games that I flip. But I don't make a lot of money. I make like $5 or $10 on a game, maybe, because I don't want to sell them for a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I just do a lot of it. I drive around town and do a lot of Facebook and a lot of Craigslist things.
Nice.
I will say, the day my car caught on fire, I was headed over to see Ken, who is at an outdoor board game sell and buy. And
did you share that story on the podcast? I think you did.
I think I did.
Yeah. He did. Yeah. He did.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Yeah.
His car catching on fire was not my fault.
I'm blaming Ken, but yeah, he says it isn't his fault, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I know I'm putting you on the spot a little bit with this, but like, I feel like another question that we generally ask guests is like, rattle off maybe like your top 5 or 6 games, or at least the top 5 that you can remember in the past recent time. That kind of gives people an idea of what you're into.
Sure. I looked at my shelf before I left because I was thinking the question might come, and I'm surprised myself because I'm a lot more of a midweight Euro person than I thought. We still play a lot of Dominion and Carcassonne. Mm-hmm. Everywhere we go, we take the great Dalmuti with us, and okay. We still play a bit of Rook. Now, there's things like Santiago and Marrakesh and Medina, which all came from here, which are top of my list.
Yeah, yeah.
Ginkopolitz, Estates in Neue Heimat, Scharfschatten.
Yep. Yeah, Estates. It's been a while since I played that one. It's a wild one.
I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's brutal and mean. A game where you can win by having negative points because you have less negative than everybody else is fantastic. And I think one of my favorite games is probably Survive Atlantis, which is just a family weight game, mm-hmm. but it's also nice and highly interactive and brutal.
So I'm sitting here feeling jealous that you like probably got Medina after you heard about it on here and after I've been looking. So I'm guessing through your digging in every corner of the earth.
I picked up Medina unpunched for $20.
You're kidding.
Wow.
Where and how?
At the Dice Tower flea market. After 3 rounds, they keep reducing the price. Uh-huh. And they came to a point where you could... I guess this was right before the last part. The last part is put as many games as you want into a box and pay $20 for it. Mm-hmm. And right before that pass, I think all the games were half off or a quarter of the original price. And nobody wanted it. So I walked in and picked it up.
Wow.
So you just got to travel to more conventions.
I was going
to
say, I got to hang on Ken's coattails.
Yeah. Cool. Well, welcome, Ken. We're glad to have you on the show.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Ken has been part of our game group for a while now, and filling in for various folks and helping us get numbers when we need numbers for playing games. And
I like to think I'm more than a number. I hope.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Not just a number. No.
I know my place. I know my place. I'm a number.
That's right.
No, I'm just saying you've been around for a long time. It's good that the listeners are finally getting introduced to you.
And a big thanks to Bill for that, because Bill brought me in, and I appreciate that. Yeah, this has been a fantastic play experience for me.
Yeah, it's funny. I had to waffle a long time. It's like, okay, should I invite Ken? Ken might replace me, because Ken knows a lot about games.
Yeah, Ken takes like meticulous notes and like details all of his plays. What do you contribute to?
I have no idea. But yes, if you look at his BGG games played, I mean, he's been super meticulous about writing when he played, who won, how long it took. I mean, just all the details.
I did that for a little while with like the app, and then I just gave up because I was like, when am I ever going to use this data? But you find uses for it.
It's all on the app for me. It makes it nice and easy. And it makes it easy to correct Chris in public when he says that a game was super, super fast. And I say, no, that took 3 hours, Chris.
Yeah.
And if you're ever correcting Chris, your stock is always going up for me. But, yeah.
I didn't get to play for 2 months after that. I'm not correcting Chris again.
That's true.
All right.
That's too funny.
Well, I have a couple of banter topics that I want to throw out there, but you go.
I'll finish up.
All right. Well, I got a show and a game, which I feel like is rare. I feel like I had big shoes to filling Chris's spot.
Oh, that's true.
Sort of in this episode. Chris always has a backlog of things to talk about, and I feel like I've been slacking the past couple episodes, or I've just been busy. So I have 2 things to talk about, proud of them.
Okay.
So the first one, ironically, I was browsing our BGG guild looking for details to help fill out my notes for this episode, and I noticed that people were actually talking about this on our BGG guild and were wanting to hear our opinions on it. So I know
Is this the show or this is the game?
This is the show. So okay,
I have a guess on which one it is because it was on Discord.
Yeah, it was on the BGG Guild.
Oh, okay.
So I'm talking about the 3-body problem.
Yes. that written on my sheet right here.
Have either of y'all read the book or watched the show?
Watched the show.
So here's the question. Which show are you watching? The one on Netflix or the one on Amazon? Because they're different. The one on Amazon is the original Chinese language version.
Oh, wow.
The one on Netflix is a redone with cool special effects and nudity and language version for Americans.
Oh, interesting. Was it different? It's different actors?
Completely different actors.
Okay, they're completely different productions then.
They're completely different productions, but they're both from the book. Okay. So I'm into both at the moment, watching them in parallel. It's extremely interesting compare the two.
Is one of them all subtitled?
Yes. The Amazon one is only available in Chinese, and you can only watch it with subtitles.
Oh, fascinating.
Well, I'll be really interested to hear your thoughts then, because I read the book originally long, long ago. I only read the first book, so it's a trilogy. It's The Three-Body Problem, The Dark Forest, and Death's End or something like that, I think, is the third book. I only read the first book, so caveat there. And to be honest, reading the book, and I'm not alone in this, I don't think, if you look around online, the book was hard to get through. It's a lot of like really high-level science-y theoretical physics stuff. And the character development in the book, I don't know. I had a hard time. I was bouncing off the writing a little bit. And maybe that's like translation because it was originally written in Chinese. It was translated. So it could be partly that. But when the show came out, I was really curious because the ideas in the book, the sci-fi ideas that came out of the book were really fascinating to me. So the premise is, it's hard to not give away too many good plot points, but it's a pretty old book at this point.
But the show's, I mean, you don't want to run the show.
Yeah,
the
show's recent. So the premise is that a Chinese physicist, well, she's the daughter of a Chinese physicist, but she herself is also a physicist. She witnesses her father get killed and as a result ends up working for the government in a top secret facility and manages to communicate with an alien race in some distant galaxy. And she establishes communication despite knowing that they're planning to come and invade. And so it sets up this premise of what? Am I giving away too much?
Well, no, but I think, I mean, I saw something different, but go ahead. I'll correct you after you get done.
Okay. Yeah, you can correct me. I'm probably giving a bad summary here, but I'm trying not to give away like too much, but essentially it's all about the dynamics of like, what would happen if we knew that this was coming and like, how would it affect politics and science and like all this stuff. And yeah, I'll let y'all fill in more details as you talk about it. But the show on Netflix that most recently came out takes pretty significant liberties, at least the version that I'm watching. I don't know about yours, Ken, but takes pretty significant liberties with the original storyline. And it somewhat blends the three books together also from what I've read about. And I've been very impressed by the show personally. I think it's fixes some of the problems that I had with the original writing, and that it kind of fleshes the characters out a little bit more, makes them a little bit more believable. I mean, there's definitely suspension of disbelief going on here, but yeah, I've been impressed so far. I've enjoyed it. So curious to get y'all's thoughts.
This is one of the few times I'm watching a show without having read the book first, so I can't compare it to the book.
Gotcha.
I've been impressed in the Netflix show with the character development. I actually think that the whole society development has taken a lot longer to develop than I thought. I've been surprised at how much time they've spent building out the characters, and I've been enjoying it so far.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would start with the girl who becomes a physicist watched her father get killed by basically a revolution, and she is seeing kind of people at their worst treat her father in the very worst way, because he's actually, you know, quoting physics and science as they're killing him, and he's basically calling him a heretic, which you can see is forming her. And then it skips to when she's an adult as a physicist, and she's working for
like a top secret military base.
Military with giant telescope or whatever.
Yeah.
But she is exposed to all these situations where the government is being just kind of horrible to the individuals. And she, when she sees this alien signal, she figures out a way to actually communicate with them by bouncing it off the sun or whatever. But because we're treating each other so badly, she receives a message from the aliens saying, don't contact us because, you know, it's not going to go well for you. And she reaches back out to them and says, this is a spoiler, by the way, so you should probably skip all this, says, go ahead and come to Earth because we're horrible people and you're going to be better than we are to ourselves. So come do that. And so to me, that kind of sets the stage for the rest of us, the rest of the show, about comparing and contrasting this point of view, where it's almost like a Garden of Eden thing. Are we kind of born evil or are we not born evil?
Is humanity redeemable or is it not?
Redeemable, exactly. Yeah. So to me, I mean, I love that dynamic, and I think it's just great writing kind of thing.
Yeah.
I have a sneaky suspicion that the Amazon one is much truer to the book because the character development and the storyline is moving much, much slower in the Chinese version one.
Yeah, and it depends on how they split it up, too, because from what I've read a little bit online today, they have merged, because there's parts of the show where I'm like, that didn't happen in the book that I read. And so I'm like, did they just take massive liberties with the storyline, or is this the other two books? And they did blend parts of the other two books in and pull them in earlier so that you kind of have more of an idea of what's coming. And so that's been interesting. Anyway, Three Body Problem. I have one episode to go. I was trying my hardest to get through the last episode, but I'm glad y'all have watched it because I was expecting
it. I haven't finished it yet. I think I'm going to be there episode 6 or 7. There's only 8. Yeah.
And so you're saying the Chinese version is on Amazon Prime?
It is. Okay. Amazon Prime.
I will have to check that out because I love the Netflix
version. And I think I'm only on episode 3 there, so I don't know quite how far it'll go.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Cool. Well, I have one other one, and that is a game this time. So this game is called Cocoon. I know, Bill, you don't have a Switch.
Nope.
But I know Chris has heard of this before. It's a puzzle game where you play this tiny little like bug man, and you're on this weird alien planet, and there's not really a storyline. It's more just like you show up on this alien planet and you're wandering around trying to figure out where you're supposed to go. But you eventually find these colored orbs and you carry them around on your back. So you can carry a single orb at a time. Except where it gets crazy is that you'll find these portals where you can place the orbs. Like placing the orbs on different pedestals and things activates, you know, switches and various things like that, standard puzzle fashion. But you can place the orbs on certain pedestals where they become portals. And then you can enter inside of the orb, which takes you into a completely different dimension. Cool. So, like, if you take the purple orb and you put it on the pedestal, you go inside the purple orb, and you might find another orb inside that one, and you can go inside that one. And so there's all this layering of dimensions, and eventually you figure out that if you carry an orb into another orb and then come back out, like, that orb is trapped. So when you look at the orange orb, you'll see the purple orb in the center of it because you took the purple orb into the orange orb. And so now when you carry the orange orb around, you're carrying both of them, and they're inside of each other. And so it's this layering of dimensions that makes the puzzle solving really unique because you're constantly jumping from dimension to dimension trying to solve these problems and moving switches around and platforms and things.
So do your dimensions have different physics in each one or are they just aesthetic?
They're mainly aesthetic. They have theming to them, like there's certain mechanics that happen in one versus others, but not necessarily physics. But the orbs also have different properties to them, too, which you figure out as you go along. Like, they're for certain particular uses. And so, it's like, well, you'll be inside the green orb, inside the purple orb, and you're like, oh, crap, I need the white orb. Because this thing I have to activate, where did I leave it? It's, you know, in some other dimension somewhere, right? So, I found that really, really fascinating. One of the most amazing things about this game, though, because really, the puzzle solving is great and is really fascinating. But I didn't find it overly difficult. Mm-hmm. We've talked about games like The Witness and other things like that on the show where the puzzle solving itself is crazy deep and difficult. You might think with this multi-dimensional thing that these are crazy difficult puzzles. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are some tough ones for sure. It kept me interested, but it's not mind-bendingly difficult problems that you're solving here. What really took it over the top, I think, is the graphics and the art direction. Like the animations and the graphics, everywhere you go, you keep moving through these new environments, and they're these crazy alien environments, and they're just so well designed, and the audio and everything put together just makes it a really cool experience. Anyway, Cocoon. I know neither one of y'all played it, but I was talking to Chris before the episode because he is actually home now, and he was like, dang it, you beat me to it. So I'm glad to be able to bring something to the table before Chris got it to the table. Yeah, that's, you know, right. What have you been up to lately, Bill?
Well, it's funny that you were inspired by the Discord channel because I was as well. And I want to say they also talked about Bodies on that. Did you see, have you watched Bodies?
I haven't. What is that?
Have you seen Bodies? It's also a Netflix thing, but it's kind of a time traveling thing. And there's a body that shows up in multiple different time periods at the same time. And it follows.
Like a dead body?
A dead body.
Okay.
And it follows.
I did watch this. I completely forgot.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think?
We liked it. I watched it with my wife.
Memorable, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So, yeah, to me, it was super cool, and I won't really get too much into it because I will just say that it's worth watching because there's just a lot that's going on, and it's to me, I'm always in awe of somebody who can write a story or a screenplay that has multiple timelines going on at the same time. And I'm a child of like Sliders and all these other time jumping things, you know, Back to the Future as a kid or whatever, and
yeah,
love those kind of things. I don't know if you saw that Dark Matter is going to have a series coming out.
I did
out.
See that.
Isn't that cool?
I think they're making, is it a movie or is it a show?
I thought it was a limited series, but I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, I just saw an advertisement for that for the first time like yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I just read that.
So. Yeah, super cool. And I'll talk about one game that I'm trying to do. So I work out of a place called Health Tracks, which is kind of funny because it's really near like this retirement community. So it's the first time I've ever been to a place where I exercise where everybody's like in their 70s, right? I think I've talked about this before. but they have a basketball court and they have Wi-Fi there. And one of the things that ever since they've come out with it on the Oculus, I've been dying to get into a place where I could actually set it up. But there's a game called Space Pirate Trainer that is one of the easy ones to show people who are new to Oculus. Basically, you're standing on a ledge in space, and then all these different kind of floating robots.
I've played this one.
I think so.
I really enjoyed that game.
Yeah, yeah. It's very cool. Because yeah, you can get multiple.
You got like the shield and the gun and
exactly, yeah, yeah. So yeah, and you can stand in one spot, so it's not going to make you nauseous or anything. So it's just a perfect game for new players to it. Well, they've come out with something called Space Pirate Arena that requires a 30-foot by 30-foot room for you to play in, and basically it'll set up a maze for you to play on with somebody else, like a multiplayer game. And so you walk down corridors. And you're given guns, like in Space Pirate Trainers, like automatic weapons, and you pick up guns and stuff like that, and you shoot at each other. It's like
you're playing a real first-person shooter, basically, walking around.
Exactly.
Now, I'm assuming since all of your opponents are 70-plus that you're generally winning this?
Well, so I haven't got it set up yet. To me, it's still a little buggy, because when you set up your Guardian in Oculus, I think it's used to being something smaller, and getting it to do 30 feet has been almost impossible. Because I've tried to do it in other places. There's also a way you can turn off your Guardian, so I'm hoping to do that. But when you turn off your Guardian completely, you need to have somebody else there who's watching you, so that you don't end up like running into the wall sometimes. So you don't really necessarily know where you are. But anyway, that is my goal, to get this set up. And I've tried a couple times for, you know, 30, 45 minutes trying to set it up until somebody came in to like play basketball or something. But I'm sure known as the super geek nerd guy at Health Tracks. But I'm going to continue to bring it in until I figure out how to set that up, and then have to come down for guest day, and we'll play a little Space Pirate Trainer Arena.
That would
be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Look it up and see the trailer. I mean, the trailer on it looks just crazy.
Nice.
So before we move into the games, I don't have one because it's not my thing, but you all have a drink today. Do you want to tell us about your drink?
Oh, yeah. We do. We do have a cocktail. Because the theme for this episode isn't really a theme. It's more just my pile of games.
It's Jason stuff.
I made a cocktail. So that's the correlation, I guess. And I made one of my favorite cocktails, and I'm kind of proud of this one, to be honest. I can't take credit for it because I didn't make it up, but I do take credit for figuring out how to make it based off of a restaurant menu. So credit goes to a restaurant here in Raleigh called Barcelona, which is like a tapas restaurant, downtown Raleigh. Great food. But I tried this the first time we went there, and it was like my favorite drink of all time. And Jenny went away for a weekend one time, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to try to see if I can figure out how to make this. Because they have the ingredient list. They don't have the proportions, but they have the ingredient list on their menu. And I was like, I'm gonna track down this stuff and see if I can figure it out. So this is called the Bourbon Spice Rack. I was trying to figure out if I had already talked about this before or not, but I don't think I have. So it is 2 ounces of bourbon, 3/4 of an ounce of cardamaro, or cynar, which is a substitute for cardamaro. Cynar is like an artichoke liqueur, which sounds gross, and it is by itself, but it's pretty good in this drink. Mm-hmm. So 2 ounces of bourbon, 3/4 of an ounce of cynar, 3/4 of an ounce of maple syrup, 1 ounce of lemon juice, and then cardamom bitters and lavender bitters. Mm-hmm. So it's a really complex
It is very complex.
Bourbon-y drink.
It has a savory and sweet kind of taste to it that is,
it's a good
complex
one.
And layered, so it's delicious.
I have a feeling this is a drink that Cameron would like if he was here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I'm pretty sure I've made it for him before. So yeah, that's what we're drinking tonight.
Good job.
All right. Well, I think that's probably good for the banter. Let's move into the games. You ready?
I'm ready.
Yeah, let's go.
Let's do it.
A long time ago in Europe, ages were dark. The distribution of wealth back then left a lot to be desired. Greedy people banded together to take things from people so that the rich could get richer and the poor could have even less. 'Twas ever thus. Step into the middle of the normal state of human affairs, as baron or baroness. Somewhere, almost in Europe, a long time ago. Thanks to your birth, you have a lot of people working to make you richer, and you, in turn, are doing your best to make your king more prosperous. If you do things right, you might someday be king.
I think your volume level goes up like by 5 when you do flavor test.
I'm enthusiastic, man.
All right, feudality.
Hey, folks. Quick note from the editor here. In standard Bill fashion, while gesticulating wildly, making some point, which I'm sure was amazing, Bill knocked his mic pretty hard. And while, of course, that part is edited out, we didn't realize until the end of the review that his mic's audio got progressively worse for the remainder of this review. While I did my best to cut out his audio when he wasn't speaking, it is noticeable, so apologies for any inconvenience. And with that, as always, we appreciate you listeners, and now back to the review.
Published in 2011 by Lookout Games and Z-Man Games, designed by Tom Wham, and ranked currently on BGG 4,764. So to talk about this game a little bit, I've heard a lot about this game from a lot of different sources. Mainly, I heard about this from Daryl Boone, who runs the Board Gems video series on YouTube, but I've heard about it from a couple other sources as well as being like kind of a kooky, it is luck-based, so surprise, surprise. First game of the episode from Jason is a luck-based game.
I'm sitting over here shocked.
Yeah, I know, you should be. But yeah, I've heard a lot of good things, that even though this is a very luck-driven game, that it's a good blend of luck and Euro. And so I was excited to give it a try. So that's how it ended up on the show. Quick rule summary for Feudality. So, in Feudality, players are feudal barons attempting to create the most famous fiefdom in the land. Each player begins the game with a player sheet that shows a 7x7 square grid representing their land. The grid is mostly open space, but contains one river spanning several spaces, along with several mountain spaces from which various ores and metals can be collected. Grid spaces will be filled throughout the course of the game with various tiles that produce, generally speaking, either resources or points. Players also start with a 2x2 castle tile that they can choose the starting location for anywhere on their map. One player is designated the senior baron, a responsibility that rotates each round, and this player will follow a series of 6 steps to complete a round. So the first step is that they will roll 2 d8 dice, a white one and a blue one, and these are used to index XY coordinates onto players' board grid. They'll place a pawn in the location where the dice line up, and every player then has a chance to activate, if possible, one tile that they had previously placed onto their grid that is either on or adjacent to their pawn. And so generally this is going to produce points, or it's going to produce resources, because that's what the tiles usually do.
I hate to interrupt you, but people are going to ask, it's a D8, and you said it was a 7x7 grid.
It is, yep. I was going to come back to that. There is, if you roll on the 8s, there is a space for the pawn to go, and it just activates the spaces next to the 8. But there aren't actual tile placement spots on the 8. If an 8 or doubles are rolled on the dice, the player continues to roll and continues to activate new locations on the map. And like I said, activating a tile generally produces either resources or points. Resources come in 5 flavors: food, stone, wood, iron, and gold. And they're generally used to purchase more tiles or for managing events that come up. Points, on the other hand, obviously move a player's pawn up on the scoring track, and pawns will be moving up and down this track constantly throughout the game. And the game ends as soon as one player crosses a certain threshold of points, depending on the player count. So, for example, in a four-player game, which is what we mostly played it at, it's 13 points. So that's the first of six steps. Roll 2d8, index into a location, activate a tile. Second step is an event card. So these come from a common deck of events. These are generally always bad. There's the occasional neutral or somewhat good event, but they're mostly bad. For example, paying taxes to the king in form of resources, or the king calls for a war and everybody has to contribute troops, or the king calls for a tournament and you can optionally send troops to compete in a tournament. Anyway, they're bad, but they equally affect everybody at the table. The third step is the purchase of tiles. So a number of tiles, two times the player count, gets drawn from a bag, and each player, starting with the senior player, gets the option to either purchase one of those tiles or to upgrade their castle. So we'll talk about what upgrading your castle means in a minute. If a player purchases a tile, they take it, they pay any resources that might be required, and they place that tile in any location that's still free on their player mat. To upgrade a castle, instead of taking a tile, the player can spend an increasing number of stone and wood resources to upgrade. So I mentioned that each player starts with a 2x2 castle square. One of those four spaces is covered by a single token that represents their fortification. So this goes from a tower to a fort to a castle to a fortress, and basically just increases the defense value of their castle and also increases the amount of points that it scores if it gets activated. The other three spaces, you might be wondering, why is the castle 2x2 if it only has one space that's actually your castle? The other three spaces hold your troops. And this is another type of tile that can be purchased, aside from point scoring tiles and resource producing tiles. Troop tiles are used to defend against attackers or to attack other players or other NPCs, non-player characters. So the fourth step is that the active player, and only the active player in this case, gets two special baronial actions. So these can either be to activate additional tiles on that player's board. In this case, it doesn't matter with a die roll. You can just choose a tile and activate it. In this case, it has to be a tile that does not produce points. So you can't just automatically score points. You can either do that twice, or you can do that once and perform a special baronial action. There are three of these. One being that you can try to liaison with the king or queen, which is basically just a die roll. And if you roll low, you lose a point. If you roll high, you gain a point. And if you roll in the middle, you get nothing. Or you can try to sabotage another player. There's a process by which you can pay some gold to try to attack a tile on another player's board. You have a die roll off and the high roller, you know, wins or loses. And if the defending player loses, they have to destroy a tile. Or you can attack another player directly or attack a non-player character or NPC, which are meant to represent like adjacent nations that have a specific defense value. Basically, anytime you're being attacked, your defense is your castle defense plus all of your troops. Anytime you're attacking, your attack value is all of your troops plus a 2d8 roll on the dice. And then finally, step 5 and 6, you feed your fiefdom. So this is the classic Euro feed your people mechanic. So for every 5 tiles that you have on your board, you must pay 1 food. And then you pass the card to the next player in line, and the game ends once somebody has passed that point threshold. So that is more or less how you play Feudality. I feel like, to kick us off, because I know based on how we started this, we're going to end up going to talking about the luck and the die rolls and everything else that goes along with this game. But I figured we should start off, let's talk about the theme. So if you look at the box for this game, based on Bill's awesome flavor text reading, you might get the impression that this is like a serious medieval heavy Euro game, and it is not. It does not take itself very seriously. It has kind of a cartoonish look to it. So what did you guys think of the look and feel of this game? Did it feel appropriate? Did the theme match up with the mechanics? How did you feel about that?
I like the theme. I thought the art on it was silly, and the silliness was good.
Yeah.
I don't know that it matters what the theming was, but I thought the theming was consistent in the sense that all the cards had a common art. They tended to use the same kind of language across of them. They put them all in the same country. It was nice. I thought it was irrelevant, but it was nice.
Foreshadowing.
Right. That's funny. I mean, I enjoyed it as well. It does look like you're looking at a comic strip a little bit when you look on it. But to me, given the whimsical nature, I think, of this game, it's kind of the target of what they were going for. So to me, it matched really well with the mechanics of it, because it's got some randomness to it, but it also gives you feelings of things that you're, you know, setting yourself up that, you know, you could call a good strategic decision if things go right. But I thought it kind of fit really well with the dynamics of how you play.
Well, and to end of that just a little bit, when you hear the rules, it sounds like this is a really complex game. It has 6 steps. The steps have a lot of parts to them.
Yeah.
In the end, this is not a particularly complex game in the sense that you get tiles that give you resources. You convert those resources into more tiles or points, basically, in order to get more resources, right? There's the battling option that comes into play, but it's not a particularly complex game. And the art, I think, helped leads into that, in the idea that it's supposed to be more fun than a serious brain burner. And I think the art adds to that.
Yeah, I mean, this feels like a variant of Settlers, almost, in a way. Like the die roll, collect resources. Everybody collects resources commonly off of a die roll, and then you do stuff with those things, right? I'm not equating it to Settlers, but it had a similar feel in terms of weight, if that's a comparison point for anybody. But yeah, I mean, I thought the theme was, for the lightness and the randomness of the gameplay, it felt like this theme helps to lighten up your expectations, maybe, right? Like, you don't go into a game with cartoon art expecting it to be like super deep and complex and like non-luck driven and, you know, everything's deterministic, right? So that helped me, at least, going into it.
But. And yet it does have the somewhat adult liaison with the king. And I think one of the things I thoroughly enjoyed was watching you try to explain to your kid, what does it mean to liaison with the king or queen?
Yeah, that was interesting. You're like, well, you're trying to get a meeting with them? Yeah.
Chance to hang out.
Yeah. It could be.
Yeah, so there's some goofy humor involved here. You can send dragons after each other, and there's one of the troops is an elephant. There's one elephant tile in the whole game.
Named Wolf.
Named Wolf. Wolf the elephant. Yeah, so there's goofy stuff going on here. All right, well, let's move on to the obvious thing then, which is the luck aspect. So you're placing tiles out onto a board. You're rolling dice. You're hoping that the dice line up with where you've placed your tiles so that you can actually collect stuff. Obviously, there's going to be some disparity in fortunes. I guess this is the best way to put it here. Specifically between me and Bill most of the time, where Bill is just racking in stuff every roll, and I'm just like sitting there
because I strategically placed my buildings in the right spot. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure that was it. So I guess, you know, it's pretty obvious that luck is an element here. Did you feel like that there were meaningful decisions to be made, I guess, is the real question.
I actually did. It took me a little bit to think through that, but it does matter where you put your tiles. This is not a serious brain burner, right? But you can place your tiles in such a way to try to quickly get to the point where no matter where the dice is rolled, you're going to land and get something. Or you can make some pretty silly mistakes, like I did, and leave some holes in your map where everybody else is getting something except for you, because you were holding out. Some of these tiles pay out more if you put them on a river or you put them on a mountain, for example.
Right, yep.
And if you're trying to hold that spot out, you might put something in a non-optimal spot in another place. And so I actually think there is some strategy to how you lay things out to do it in the best way possible, and which tiles to use, whether you're going to go heavy on points or heavy on resources, and maybe that changes partway through the game as the game develops.
Yeah, I kind of started to get that feel too. I think there is definitely a transition point that has to happen at some point in the game, and figuring out when you need to make that switch from I'm getting more tiles that produce resources so that I can build up my engine to I'm just laying out tiles that score points so that every time the die gets rolled, I score points. There is a line somewhere in there that you have to find. And I found that interesting to try to figure that out. Like, do I need a tile that produces every type of resource right? Or do I focus on, you know, on specific things and try to narrow down what I'm going after, and then maybe try to make that transition to points a little earlier so that I can try to get a jump on it. But then you're at risk of potentially not having food when you need food, right? I did find those decisions to be interesting.
Yeah. The other thing I thought was kind of interesting is if you go the resource route, as you upgrade your castle, it has victory points associated with it. And your first level is 1 point, your second level is 2 points, your third one's three, and your fourth one's four. So you will, at some point, if you upgrade completely, be able to move four points on your victory track with one dice roll.
Or if you're build 12 in three turns.
And 12 in three turns, exactly. So you can swing the game, but you are making a sacrifice when you do that, because you do have to buy the resources or the cards that allow you to get those resources, because it gets to be really expensive. And you're foregoing chips that may, you know, inch you up one at a time that you might have scattered around all over your board. So, I mean, I think there's multiple paths of victory.
But you could also do all of that investment, get your level 4 castle, and then have it never be rolled.
That's right? True. Exactly. Because it's a luck game. Although, yeah. There is a wizard that if the combo of the wizard allows you to re-roll one of your dice, so you have at least two shots to get to hit your...
When it's your turn, at least.
When it's your turn, right, exactly. Yeah. But if you have the wizard, you also have a chance to re-roll that dice if you hit somebody else's castle. So you can say, oh, no, don't cash that in. I'm going to re-roll my wizard so that you can keep somebody else from moving up. So, I mean, I think there is some strategy to it.
Yeah, so I didn't really mention there are some tiles that kind of give you these passive abilities. There aren't many of them, but there are some. Bill mentioned the wizard that lets you re-roll a die once per turn. I think there's also one. I didn't go deep into like battle and war, but anytime you contribute troops to a war, you have to roll a die for every single troop that you contributed. And if you roll odd, the troop dies and you just lose it. If you roll even, the troop lives and you get to keep it. And so there are tiles that, like, for instance, let you re-roll a die whenever you send a troop off to war or whatever. So there are some additional things to think about in that respect.
So I do like that the events affect everybody equally in most cases. I'm not a big fan of games where bad things happen asymmetrically to people.
Yeah.
And most of the events happen to everybody or they happen to nobody.
Minus
the dragons. But I thought that was a good thing, just on the whole, especially for a family game, because it means that somebody's not necessarily getting picked on quite as much.
Right. But I like the dragons as well, because it can help pull back a leader. So
that's true. Possibly. Right. Which is what happened to me at least once.
Yeah, you can put the dragon on yourself, and if you can beat it, then you get the benefit of beating it. I think it's worth noting the one event card, which I find hilarious, that's in the deck. Well, hilarious / potentially frustrating, depending on how you want to look at it. The Black Death. There's a singular card in the deck where basically it negatively impacts everybody the same, but it just gives everyone -3 points. And then it goes in the box, and then you're done, and you move on.
The game's going to last a little longer now.
Yeah, which I guess, I guess that's the usefulness of it, if somebody's running away with it, it pulls everybody back equally and buys you more time, I suppose. But I think we hit that card. I mean, it's a pretty large event deck, and I think we hit that card in every game that we played of this.
And this could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you feel about it. But I don't think we had to reference the manual much at all. But pretty much all the cards, the tiles, even when they're more complex, they have text written on them.
Yeah.
So that's nice. It just keeps you having to go back over and over.
That's true. All right. Well, those are some good things. What did we like less about this game? I know I have a few, but I'm gonna let you all talk first.
Bill, why don't you go?
The only thing, well, I have maybe a couple things. I'll start with there's a secondary card that when you're doing your baronial actions that has probably five or six things you can choose from. If you kind of math things out, there's some things that maybe don't make sense to do, at least, and we might have had some groupthink going on, but one thing we didn't do very much was attack other people. And looking at some other reviews that are out there, some other people had said, you know, I really like attacking somebody because it's, you know, it gives you a good feeling of satisfaction when you can remove that wizard off the other guy's board or something like that. But you really have to be, you know, fairly lucky to be able to achieve that. You have a big
super
army.
Risky. That action in particular, I think the sabotage action is basically you roll 1d8. Whatever number comes up, you have to pay that much gold to even be able to do the action at all. And then if you pay the gold and you do the action, then it's a 1d8 roll-off between you and the other player. You have to beat them. It's just a 1d8 versus 1d8. And if you beat them, you have to exceed, not tie, then they destroy their tile. Otherwise, you lose a point, which is pretty costly. So,
So I will say, the things on that card didn't seem to add a lot to the game as far as those choices. So
that was my number one negative I wrote, is that largely I thought the baronial cards, and again, maybe it was groupthink, felt almost entirely useless, with the exception of the liaison, which we used a lot. Because even the others almost all cause you to initiate a war. So even if you're successful, and to go back to the war action, you end up having to roll a die for every troop that you used in this action, which is one of the tiles that you have previously gone off and bought. If you roll an even, you get to keep it. If you roll an odd, you have to throw it away. Yep. And so you may have built up troops to make sure you're going to win a fight, which means you are placing more at risk than the person you're attacking, potentially, because you might lose even more people than they did. So you've spent a bunch of turns to build up some power, and then you reset yourself down to half of that. It's a killer. And I just don't understand. We never used it, I think.
Yeah,
when we
the
played.
Troops are really expensive too. I think that's the biggest thing that I struggled with, because I went into one game, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to focus on military. I'm just going to build up my military. I'm going to go hard after the iron resource so that I can buy lots of troops and just be able to like attack these, even the NPCs, like attack the non-player character nations that just have a set defense value, and just go after that and just score points off of it every round. Well, I bought like two troops the first round. We got called into a war or something by one of the event cards, and I had to roll the stupid, you know, odd or even die for my troops. I lost both of them. I was like, well, that was like three turns to acquire that stuff, and it's going to take me a ton of time and a lot of luck of rolling my, you know, iron resources again to even be able to attempt to build back.
And you lost the opportunity cost that you could have two other tiles on your board that's giving
exactly.
you the resources.
And I think that's the frustration of why it looked like Bill was so successful, is he was covering a lot more of his board.
He didn't actually do anything to win. That's what was frustrating.
I'm a pacifist. Who needs that military? You know?
Yeah, I will say one of the things that I pointed out too was the food thing. The feeding troops felt like an odd fit. It felt like this was like the Euro thing to do. Like it's the most Euro-y Euro thing to add to a game, is that you have to feed your workers or whatever, right? But that mechanic seems to make a lot more sense in a game where your need to feed your troops is not the same as everybody else. But if you think about it, everyone acquires one tile every round. No exceptions. There's not a way to get more tiles in a round. There's not a way to really get less tiles. I suppose you could choose to just not buy a tile. But even if you upgrade your castle, you're adding a tile to your board. So every round, everybody goes up by one tile. So everybody's requirement for food goes up by one tile every round.
And unless you've lost them, as you're pointing out.
True. But in that case, you know, you've got other problems, right? So it just felt a little weird to me. I mean, and yes, there are tiles out there that you can invest in, you can buy, that makes your food cost less, like it halves your food cost or whatever. But I felt like everybody saw that as the same advantage. And by, you know, midway through the game, everybody has one of those. And so it's like, it just felt a little tacked on to me.
What that meant for me in play is that almost always one of my baronial actions
is get food.
Was to get food.
Exactly.
And so I only ended up with one action.
Yeah, which I think is what happened to most people. So maybe we're playing it wrong. I don't know. But that seemed a little strange to me.
I have another minor nit. So one of my jobs while we played, I just took it upon myself, was to refill the market every time. There's a bag.
Yep.
Every single turn, you have to go and pull 8 tokens out of the bag.
Ken
lay them out on the board.
Cursing himself every time because you forget or knock over a pile. Or
it makes the game go faster to have these piles, but you can't prep them all beforehand because there's some actions that cause you to throw everything else back in the bag. So you can't prep everything beforehand. But it's a delay of game sort of thing to stop and
it's
refill
tedious.
That market every single time.
Yep. All right. Well, anything else we want to throw out there for this one? I will say, did you guys feel like there is some take that in this as well? I feel like it's worth mentioning. you know, the dragons, I guess, are the primary thing. But I know, Ken, you got burned by this.
I got burned by the rat catcher. So, I made the comment that the events are largely to everybody, but there are definitely some take that ones, like the rat catcher, which requires you to pay one more food on top of all the regular.
Right, and takes a point away from you.
So I would like to throw in a scalability comment, which I know is not something you all normally do, but I play a lot of games two-player, and so I think with every game, how would this game scale up or scale down?
Right, yeah. It plays up to six.
Plays up to six.
We didn't play it at that count.
It might be more interesting to play higher. I think we played it at both 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly, we just made the comment about the event cards, and there is some take that. I think, except where those comes in, this is largely multiplayer solitaire. I don't know that it would change much with player count. I think it's basically the same game with all player counts. So you're basically filling out your board from the market. It's just about who steals from the market before you. But the market grows based on more people. So I think it's mainly a multiplayer solitaire kind of thing.
Yeah, and you are getting benefit, theoretically, depending on luck, from every person's turn, right? So that's that Catan mechanism where, you know, everybody who rolls, you're potentially getting something from it.
That is a pro, right? There's not a lot of downtime at an individual level in this game.
Unless you're not getting dice rolled for yourself, in which case you're waiting 5 turns to actually be able to get the chance to, like, actually do something.
Because you built your military instead of buying your resource cards or chips.
Yeah. All right. Well, I feel like we've covered a good bit of ground on this one. We want to kick off final thoughts?
Sure.
Here we go.
All right. Yeah, Bill, kick us off. We'll let Ken go last on the first one here.
Okay. I will say that I like this game. I mean, to me, it's doing what it set out to do. It is kind of a lighthearted game. You do move up and down your victory track from, I won't say seemingly random reasons, but you can. There was a lot of 2 steps forwards, 1 step back kind of things. And the leaders can kind of move around fairly easily. It does give you a sense, or at least I felt a sense, that I did have kind of a strategy that I was coming out, and I felt good when the dice rolled my way. So to me, if you're like curating games and you're having that mid-range group of people who aren't gonna, you know, enjoy the heavier games, I think this has a great niche for the people who like board game lights. And I'm glad we talked about, you know, Ken, I'm glad you talked about the scalability thing. I like the fact that I think it could go to 6 pretty easily, and everybody can be occupied at the table while you're doing it. So when I'm thinking about, like, my family, I think this game would go well at my beach vacations, because it's a fast teach. You're not knowing the rules. Everybody gets it right away, and, you know, they feel like they're competitive kind of thing. So I'm going to give it a solid 4. I enjoyed my plays. And of course, I won, but, I mean, I've
luck,
got the glow
pure
factor.
Luck.
So, and I'm sitting over here in shock that this came off of Jason's shelf, and I liked it. So, yeah, I'm still going to give it 4.
Yeah, I mean, I had to throw something out there, you know, throw people off a little bit.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you liked it, Bill. I will say I came into this game with high expectations because I had heard a lot of really good things about it from a lot of different sources, like I mentioned at the beginning. And I tried to come into it with an open mind because it doesn't take itself very seriously. And so I think anyone who is playing this game also needs to come at it with, you know, the right level of expectation, right? And so I can see there being an audience for this game if you were looking for a lighthearted, random die rolling, you know, yelling and shouting when your tile gets rolled and that kind of thing. And it does have the appearance of there being some strategic decisions to make. I'm not sure how much those strategic decisions actually matter in the end, aside from making sure that you have coverage on your board to get stuff rolled, because you can't control what's going to come up and what's going to be available. That said, I don't think it should be any surprise to anybody who's ever listened to this show that I don't know that audience is me for this particular game. I didn't hate my plays of it, but I don't really have a desire to play it ever again, mainly because in all the plays that we did, I felt like the winner was just randomly determined. It was everybody kind of has point scoring potential. Everybody has resource producing potential, more or less. But some people, their number got rolled a couple times in a row and they won, right? And I'm not disparaging you, Bill, and your deep level of strategy that you applied to this game.
Oh my God.
You had the best layout possible, and you planned it from the beginning, and it was perfect. But I think that personally, for me, I don't know that I would want to continue playing this game. So for me, it falls into a three category. I don't think it's a bad game, necessarily, if you go into it with the right mentality. But for me, like I said, I don't want to keep playing it. So it's just a three.
Well, this is an interesting set of recommendations. So I don't hate dice games. I have Twa and enjoy Twa. We have Rogers of the Ganges. We like that. I even have Roll for the Galaxy. So I love Role Player, even though Bill hates it. So I debated on giving this a two or a three.
Yeah. Okay.
When it comes down to it, I have no desire to own it. So it's not a four for sure. But really, I have no desire to ever play this again, which I think makes it a two.
Yeah.
If it played out in 20 to 30 minutes, it would be an easy three for me. But our games took us about an hour and a half apiece. And it for me, that was an hour and a half of what felt like one step forward and two steps back. One step forward, two steps back.
Yep.
And at the end, after about a 45-minute mark, I just wanted the games to end. It didn't feel like I was accomplishing much. And the greatest strategy I started to develop was to try to figure out what Bill was doing and do what Bill did. Because whatever Bill was doing was clearly working. In the last game, I think I was winning by a fairly large... Well, no, because I think your daughter was close.
Yeah.
But no, it just... There was too much luck for me for such a long game. So again, if it was a 20 or 30-minute game... But for me, and I understand what you all are saying in terms of how other people might like it, but I think I have to judge it for what I would want to play. And for me, I think it's a two. I don't care to play it again.
Yeah. Cool. As you should. Yeah. Bill might be acquiring a copy of this game shortly. All right. Well, some varying opinions there, but I like it when we disagree. So if you're interested in Feudality, where can you find it aside from my shelf? There are no copies available on Noble Knight, currently our sponsors. However, there are 18 copies available on BGG for a variety of price points. So, and Bill might be acquiring a copy soon. Yeah. So those are our thoughts on Feudality.
Campanile, the towers of the powerful. Only those at the top have the say. So you cleverly use your cards to increase or hinder gigantic towers. Bet on the highest towers, and in the end, with the greatest power value, you are toweringly superior to all of the others. Campanile, a competition that leads to the top.
Nice. Good translation of the German there.
Yes. Thank you to Google Translate.
All right. Campanile. So I only have the German version of this game. I'm not even sure there is an American version, to be honest. But this game was published in 1996, so going way back. And I think my copy actually says 1995 on the side, but I went with what BGG
1994
said.
On the back of the box.
Wow. All right. I was 11. Published by Blatz and DDD Verlag GmbH. Designed by Hanno and Wilfried Kuhn. And currently ranked on BGG 8,620. So, quick rules summary. Campanile is a tower-building bidding card game in which players attempt to bid on which of five towers they believe will be the tallest by the game's end. The game's comprised primarily of a deck of tower cards, showing five different tower facades. Players are each dealt three cards from a shuffled deck, and the remainder of the deck is divided into three equal face-down stacks. These stacks are placed over top of three numbered finito or end cards, and the top card of each stack is revealed. Five tower base cards, matching the five different facades, are placed in a line next to the card stacks. Finally, each player is given several bidding chips of different sizes in their player color. So one large chip worth 3 points, three medium chips worth 2 points each, and five small chips worth 1 point each. Each tower card in a player's hand shows three levels of tower, separated by tick marks on the card's edge to help with aligning them. Starting with the first player and continuing around the table, players will take turns playing single cards from their hand to raise the top of one of the five towers by one, two, or three levels depending on how the card is placed, overlapping the previous highest card of that tower. The number of stories added is significant for a couple of reasons. First, it determines how much that particular tower is going to grow in height. That's the obvious one. But second, it determines which size of bidding chip the player is able to bid with that round. So a player's turn is place a card to raise a tower, then bid if they want to, and then draw a new card. So the number of stories that you add to the tower determines what size of chip you have to bid with. Raising a tower by one level requires bidding with a small chip, two levels, a medium chip, three levels, the large chip. A player can always choose to not bid, but if they want to bid on a turn, they have to follow that rule. Players need not bid on a tower that they just added a card to. In fact, there is an additional rule that a player may only bid on a tower which is represented in the cards currently revealed at the top of the three card stacks. So if the tower you want to bid on doesn't show at the top of one of those stacks, you can't bid on it. Once a player raises a tower, then optionally bids, then finally they draw a card to replace the one that they just used. This, again, is controlled by the number of stories or levels added to the tower by the card that the player played. So the card must be drawn from the numbered stack matching the number of levels added. The game ends immediately once the final card of any one of those three draw stacks is drawn, and at that point, the height of the towers is compared, and flag scoring cards are awarded with more valuable scoring cards awarded to the higher towers. Each flag card shows two numbers, the higher awarded to the player with the most bidding chips under that tower, the lower number awarded to the player with the second most bidding chips. And the flag scoring cards are like 8 points and 4 points, 6 points and 3 points, 4 points, 2 points, and so on. But there are only four of these cards, so the smallest tower will receive no points. Each player tallies their awarded points, and most points wins the game.
So one maybe rule clarification, it's not the number of chips, but the value of the chips. So your three chip counts as three, your two chip counts as two, your one chip counts as one.
Yep. Good clarification. So I think the most unique aspect of this game has to be the way that like the number of levels that you add with your card placement impacts not just the height of the tower, but it also impacts what type of chip you can bid, and it impacts what card you're drawing. So it kind of tightly couples everything together. How did you guys feel about that? Did you think that it added to the game, pulled away from it? What did you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of empathizing with the listener, because this is kind of a hard game to envision, even though when you're looking at it, it's pretty easy rules. But that rule restriction where you're growing a tower limited by betting by the cards that you see in the table in the three stacks, and then the next card that you're choosing, bundles a whole bunch of strategic decisions all in one tight little package, because every one of them, and I'm sure this is all gonna be teased out as we discussed it, but there's like five different things that are going on with you just placing that card on a tower and choosing that level one, two, or three, both offensive and defensive, and you know how you're gonna bet. I mean, it's this game. One of the lead questions we talked about starting with was, did this game surprise you? And this game to me was shocking, the level of strategy that you're thinking about when you're thinking about those rules that you're talking about and how you execute with them.
Yeah, and I totally realize now that I wrote down that question underneath the first one and then missed it and read my question instead of yours.
So, but I totally agree with Bill. You're looking at this thinking, okay, I want to make Tower A, this one closest to me, the tallest. Maybe you don't have any cards for A in your hand right now, but there's one of those sitting out in one of those three piles, but it's in the three pile. Now, you don't want to let somebody else get it, because maybe they're going to take it, and if they take it, they're only going to use it to build out a one story, and you really want to use that card to build out a three story. So you're thinking, I want that. But the only way you can get it is to play another one of your cards, add a three story, which is going to make another tower even taller. Yep. And so do you play and build out another tower so that you can get that card that you really, really want? You know, what do you do? But maybe you've already played out a three card before. You only get one three card bidding token. So now in order to get the card you want, you play into a tower, at a three level, but you've wasted a chance to bid. And maybe the game will end then before you get all your bidding tokens out, because you're wasting time on plays that don't allow you to bid. There's so many strategies.
And then you could take that card that you really wanted and bid on that tower, but then that card's not represented in the three stacks anymore, so you can't bid on it anymore.
Right, right. And that was something I don't think was obvious to any of us in the first play.
Yeah.
That you can only bid on a card, on a tower, that is showing in the draw decks. And it may take a very long time before the tower you want to bid on shows back up. And if it's in the late game, it may not show up at all. So you have a card in your hand, you know, that you can't do anything super useful with from a bid perspective.
Yeah. Like Bill said, this is a tricky one to explain the nuance to. And we don't want to get too deep into the weeds here, but there are so many fascinating things going on with such a simple card placement. And I think you guys have been alluding to it all along. You want to get your chips out on the board, right? You have all the, you have, what is it? One large one, three, and then five, so nine chips, right? And so ideally, you would be placing a card and placing a bidding chip every round. But you don't know at the beginning of the game which towers are going to be the highest. So right. You might be thinking, well, I slow play. I'll play out my one chips, my small chips, and, you know, gradually build up. You don't know if you're going to have enough turns to get your big chips out, right?
Right.
And you're also balancing all these other decisions of, you know, trying to figure out what card you want to draw and which tower do I want to add to versus, you know, where do I want to bid and what things are available to bid now. And yeah, there's just so many things going on here. I thought the draw pile thing was actually really interesting when I finally got it, because there are situations where I might not want other people to be able to bid on a specific tower, right? So it's like, well, I'm going to go for that card. I'm going to take that card because I have a lot of bidding chips on that tower and I don't want anybody else to be able to put bidding chips there. So if I take it off the draw, off the draw stack, nobody is able to bid there anymore.
Right.
Now, granted, I think two times in a row I tried to do that and the very next card underneath that was the same exact card. Right. So it happens.
It does.
But yeah, even choosing which card you draw, it's not just which tower do I want to grow on my next turn the most. It's, well, I could also be denying people the ability to bid on things. Or when the decks start getting low, it's also like, how quickly do I want the game to end? Right, because if I run out of stack, the game immediately ends at the end of that. Right?
There's both an offensive and a defensive way in both playing your cards out and choosing what to take.
Right,
because it is interesting how the game develops, because you can't bid and compete in every tower. So there's a push and pull of, okay, I'm going to try to be, or I think I'm going to try to be in first place on this tower. And if you notice, like, there's a couple other players on the board who are spending lots and lots of chips on another tower that you know you can't compete on anymore, you might take a card for that tower and actually put a one tower level growth on that tower because and try to catch up with your tower later with three levels. So, in Ken, to your point about playing defensively, if you actually grow the other tower more slowly than other people would, it may help you in the long run.
Absolutely.
So it's there's so many things to think about in this game.
And I thought they made a brilliant design decision on how they split the bidding tokens out by giving you a lot of ones, right? And the only way you get to put out a one bidding token is put out a one story in terms of a tower. So they're really incentivizing you to do a lot of really small growth in order to get your bidding tokens out. Which means in a way you're doing exactly what Bill is saying, right? Playing your little bitty guys on other people's towers so that you can bid on the one that you want, which I just thought was brilliant.
Yeah, and it also somewhat disincentivizes playing threes, right? Because like ideally, if you have a tower that you're heavily invested in, you want to just be dropping cards on there at level three. But assuming you've already invested your level three bidding token somewhere, from that point on, anytime you play a level three, you're not getting another token out. You're increasing the height of your tower by a lot, but you're not getting another token out. And so it's this constant tension of, I want to get more of my tokens out, so I need to play smaller increments, but I also want to grow the towers that I'm invested in. And I thought it was interesting too, because playing a single story can be really valuable, right? If you're playing on somebody else's tower that you want to stay small, playing a one story on there is great, right? Because you're exhausting a card option out of the deck, right? Every tower has a limited number of cards in the deck. So the more get played as a one, the less potential that tower has, right? So you're eking away potential, but you are still growing their tower just so that you can get a bidding chip out,
yeah.
right? At the expense of potentially growing your own tower. So there's just so much tension.
And that makes for a really interesting early game, mid game, late game dynamic.
Absolutely.
Because if you build out towers very quickly at the beginning, you try to shoot that tower up, people start wanting to put bidding tokens on it because they're thinking, oh, that's going to be a really high tower.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But as you just pointed out, you may have just come short. I mean, and there just may not be that many more cards that can be laid out on it. Mm-hmm. And the odds that you're going to have one in your hand and it will be out on the draw pile at the same time when that tower is coming close to being the end. A lot of tension there. And I think the game changes near that mid-late game and what decisions you're going to make.
Right. Because you're also thinking, as you're laying things out, I want to keep my three or two tokens back so that I can snipe pretty big on some of those towers that are close to number one or two, so that you can pull that in and pull a surprise move. However, it can get away from you really easily because the game can end, or you can have two or three turns in a row that you can't bid on that tower that you think you want to snipe. So I think you got
burned in that once where Jason and I both really burned through the one tower a lot faster than you thought we were building through the one pile.
Yeah.
You got burned by that too, Ken, because we were all terrified because the whole game, Ken had his big three token just sitting there like as a threat. It's like, oh man, like which tower is he going to place this on? But it came down to it, you needed to put it out, and it just wasn't the tower that you needed to put it on wasn't available at the time. So you're playing this like push your luck element along with everything else that's going on here.
But I'll point out, I got burned there because of a brilliant play that you made. I mean, you saw what I needed. You took it off the draw pile to make sure I couldn't bid on it the next round, even though it wasn't a card you needed. And
I don't know that it was intentional, but I'll take the brilliant.
It sure
move.
Looked it looked that way. But I guess I say that to say, it's not just about the luck of what shows up in this. I think there's a lot of both strategy and tactics that can come into play in here.
Yeah,
yeah. To me, this is a game of kind of evolving fuzzy logic, because it's just the tower that you think you're going to be bidding on the whole time may just change abruptly with two or three moves. They're saying, okay, I might drop this one or settle for second place easily and partner with somebody else, because this is a little bit of a shared incentive games up until like the last few turns where he's like, okay, I'm going to jump ahead of this last person if I can.
That was a big difference between, I think, our three-player play and a four-player play.
Mm-hmm.
There was teamwork happening more in the four-player game, mm-hmm. where people were sharing a tower and saying, mm-hmm. hey, we're going to jump this guy up and shunt some other people out. And mm-hmm. that didn't really happen as much in the three-player game.
That's true. That's absolutely true. I liked the three-player game better, I think, because it felt, I don't know. I wouldn't say it's more controlled, but maybe it is. I felt like I had more visibility into, I think, what was happening in the future, and I had more control of my future. In a four-player game, it felt like it did start getting a bit more random before it got to be my turn again, kind of thing.
Yeah, I will say the number of towers doesn't scale with player count, and we only played it at three and four. It feels like it would be very chaotic at five, because you just have way more competition for chips. Mm-hmm. So it feels like even at four players, you needed to really like pick a tower and invest. Like, you can't spread out as thin, because you're just going to lose everywhere, because there's enough people that if you're spread thin, somebody is going to come over top of you and take at least second place over you and leave you in the dust, and then all your bidding chips are worthless. In a three-player game, it felt like you could try to hedge your bets a little bit more and spread a little bit more thin and play the game. I wonder if in like a five-player game, you kind of just have to pick a tower and commit, and it becomes more of a battle of like battling to see who can get their tower to be the highest through card play more than it is like strategic bidding. But I don't know. I would be curious.
I had the same scalability note that I thought it played well at three and four. I'm concerned that five would turn into a bit more luck, and more in the moment decisions, because so many changes can happen to the towers before it comes back to you.
Right. Yep.
Every game we played, just for what it's worth, took about a half an hour. So the game was pretty constant, no matter how many times we played or how many people we played with, which was nice.
Yeah, it's fairly quick.
Transition to negatives.
Yeah. I think there's an obvious one here.
Ah, interesting. So mine would be that everybody has to be awake. We made a lot of potential card placement problems. And well, I guess two things in terms of being awake. Multiple times somebody made a mistake, tried to take a card you can't take, or right, tried to bid on something you can't bid on, because that connection is strictly enforced. You only get to take from the two pile if you build a two-story card. So everybody has to pay attention all the time. Mm-hmm. But the cards are also difficult to lay on top of in a way that I think makes it really easy and obvious what you just did. So there were multiple times somebody would try to lay down a three-story card and accidentally make a two-story card.
Yep.
And I think you have to be super careful in that to make sure you did what you really meant to do, because it changes everything about the game.
Yeah, a little fiddly that way.
I think that leans into my con that I was saying was obvious. The components here are not top-notch, right? This is 1994. The bidding chips we're talking about here are like the little plastic tiddlywinks. The cards feel like, I equated this to like when you buy your kids like the Valentine's Day cards that they take to school, and it's, you know, the little perforated cardboard, thin cardboard. Like, that's what the cards feel like for this game. So it's not super high quality. I didn't have a problem with the art. I felt like the art was, you know, was reasonable for what it was trying to accomplish. But the component quality leaves a little to be desired, to be honest. And that kind of goes into that whole like overlaying the cards and trying to get the little tick marks to line up. And if you bump a pile, it's like, well, we're done. We just reset the game, you know.
I'm not a game designer, but I couldn't figure out how to do it differently. I don't think you could build your tower up, because the towers would get so tall, I think they would fall over and it wouldn't particularly work all that well. So I don't know how else you would do it. But like you said, if you touch a pile and accidentally knock it and confuse cards, that whole game is over.
Yeah. It can also be kind of hard to like compare the heights of the towers, honestly, because they're, you know, they're such small increments that when you get to the end, it's like, oh, is that one, did we just shuffle the cards a little tighter on that side, or is it actually shorter?
You sort of have to count ticks.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I feel like we've covered the bases. Final thoughts?
Who's going first?
I can kick this one off, I guess. So I will say this game surprised the heck out of me. If you look at it, it looks like it's from 1994, and it's a tiny little box. And I think I threw this in as like an add-on game from my like giant shipment of games that I bought from Europe 2.5 years ago when we started this podcast. And it went on a shelf, and I never looked at it again until I was preparing for this podcast. It just happened to show up in like the games that I was browsing like way back then, and I was like, oh yeah, throw it on there, they have it. This game surprised me. I did not have that high expectations going in. I needed a shorter game for the podcast. And dude, this game has so much to think about. I still don't feel like I have like a super good grasp over like the ideal way to play this game. And that's a good thing. I think there are different things to try. There are plenty of things to think about throughout. It plays short. I think as a filler, this is ideal in my mind. Like a great amount of depth, easy rules. Yeah, there is that trickiness of wrapping your brain around the whole number of stories thing and how that all ties together. I wish the components were better. I wish this would be reprinted. I think it could do really well. But I give this a solid 5. I really, really enjoyed our plays of this. I think it could go potentially even higher, like in the filler category with more plays. I do have concerns at the higher player count, but I think if you're playing this at 3 or 4, like it's a solid one. So solid 5 for me.
Cool.
All right, I'll go. I wholeheartedly agree with everything you said. I thought this was fantastic. Very much surprised me. So my guideline for a 5, my wife limits me to shelf space. So I'm allowed to fill up my 3 bookshelves that are in the living room. And if a game comes in, it means something else has to leave.
Well, this is a tiny one, so you got
it. It would, but it would mean another tiny one would have to leave, and I would exit out something else from my collection to bring this one in. I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Nice.
I wish the components were a little better. You know, there's some things that I would change. I wish we could find some way to make it so that if a cat jumps up on the table and it touches your your card, you don't lose an entire round. But you know, it's only a 30-minute game, and so if something gets lost that way and you have to restart, then you have to restart. So I also made this a 5.
Nice.
Wow. I think we're gonna I'm going to give this one a 2 because you guys are great. No, I'm just kidding. I have to agree with you. This is shockingly good. I have to say, I thought about Chris a lot as we played this game, and I can't wait for him to play it just because it does give you a lot of difficult decisions, and there's just a lot of kind of things to think along the fly, on the fly as you're doing it. I do think that, you know, this is a kind of a strategic thinking filler, which is a rarity, which is, I think, puts it in a class kind of by itself sometimes. So, which I think is absolutely awesome. And I'm going to give it a 5 as well. I thought it was great, and I've been looking for it. So, I think it's going to come true.
This was a great choice, Jason.
That's right. Nice. We're shocked about Jason and his finds.
I know. See, I do have good games every once in a while, guys. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Chris is going to have to up his game.
Right. All right. Well, if Campanile interests you, there are copies available from Noble Knight for around $25, which I will say is a little on the high side. I'm not sure why they're quite so expensive on there. There are 20 copies available, however, on BGG for a good bit less than that, if that interests you. So check it out. Definitely a good one to try. Yeah, those are our thoughts on Campanile. Actually, Bill, why don't you say that this time? I did it last time.
And those are our thoughts on Campanile. Campanile. It's Italian.
I'm going to leave that in there.
Founded in 1608 by Samuel de Champlain, the city of Quebec is without a doubt one of the most historically significant cities in North America. Throughout the 4 centuries of its existence, the fate of this city has been governed by the various human activities that are the foundations of Western civilization. Religion, politics, economy, and culture have all left their mark on this World Heritage Site. In Quebec, you are in charge of a rich family whose goal is to acquire influence by building the city of Quebec. The game covers 4 centuries during which you will build the most prestigious buildings and places of the city, all the while ensuring your presence in the great spheres of power. It is up to you and your adversaries to build Quebec in your colors.
That was very exciting there, Jason.
Colors with a U. All right.
Was that a... I don't know what you get a straight English translation.
Yeah, I had to look up the English rules on this one. So I only have the French rules in my copy, and Google Translate was not doing a good job on this one, unfortunately. All right. Published in 2011 by Scorpion Mask, Asmodee, Spielworks, and Istari Games. Quebec is designed by Philippe Baudouin and Pierre Poissant Marquis, and is currently ranked on BGG 1,912. So this rules explanation for Quebec is going to have some gaps because this game is a little on the heavier side. So I'm going to do my best to give you a picture of how it plays, but without going super deep into everything. So there will be a few rules missing here. But Quebec is a pretty unique worker placement / area control game about constructing buildings in the city of Quebec. The board is comprised of several cardboard discs, each representing a building waiting to be constructed in the city. One side shows a completed building, the other shows a Roman numeral between 1 and 4, which represents the century, or overall round, in which that building is available for construction. Each disc also shows 3 spaces for players to contribute materials for the construction of that building, and these function essentially as both worker placement spots as well as area control spots. The discs are arranged in a grid and are of 1 of 4 colors. The grid on the board is also grouped into blobs, is what we call them, of 3 to 4 spaces of the same color that surround an empty space that shows an action that is printed there. Discs are randomly placed out onto the grid following the required colors of the spaces, and since all the discs are really the same aside from their color and the Roman numeral, essentially what's being randomized here is the locations that will be available during each of the 4 centuries. Around the perimeter of the board, specifically in the corners, are 4 special areas representing the arts,
economics, religion, and politics. And these areas are used for scoring at the end of each century or round and have colors that correspond to the four colors of discs on the map. There's also a fifth scoring area connected to the city itself called the Citadel. And I'll talk more about what those scoring areas are used for in a second. Each player has a supply of cubes, three of which start out available to them in their supply, while the rest are held to the side and form their reserve. Players also have a pile of cardboard chits with stars on them, between one and three stars. I'll talk more about those in a second as well. And an architect player pawn. So on a player's turn, they have a choice of four things that they can do. They can take a roll card. So there are five of these. They're special rolls. Are always the same in each game. But they're pretty powerful, depending on what they do. I'm not going to go through the specifics of what each of these do. But essentially, they grant the player who takes them a special ability for the remainder of the current century. And players may only have one of these each century. The second option on a player's turn is that they can move a single cube from their supply to any one of the five special areas, the corners or the citadel. This is kind of a rarer action. It's not really a common move, but it can be helpful in the right circumstances that might become apparent later on. The third action that a player can do on their turn is that they can move the architect pawn onto a building disc. The disc has to be one that is available in the current century, and it may not have another player's architect already on it, and it can't obviously already be completed. Every time this happens, the player gets to also move three cubes from their reserve to their supply, and on their first placement, that's all that happens. They place their architect on a building, they get three cubes into their supply, and their turn is done. After that, players will be moving their architect from one building to another, and at that point, some additional things happen, but I'm not going to talk about those until I talk about the fourth action that you can do on your turn, which is to contribute to a building that is under construction. So what that means is, if you remember, I said that each building disc has three placement spaces on it. So players use these spaces to contribute building materials, which is cubes from their supply, to that particular building. The number of cubes required is determined by the colored blob that the discs belong to. So it's either one, two, or three cubes per spot. This obviously can only be done three times per building because there's only three spaces. A single player can contribute more than one time to the same building if they want and they're able to. And players can contribute to both buildings with their own architect, but also contribute to buildings that have another player's architect on them. And that may actually be more advantageous, and usually is, because those actions that were printed on the colored blobs are only activated when a player places a contribution on another player's building. So if you contribute to your own building, you don't get to activate the action for that. Whereas if you contribute to another player's building, it's like a worker placement spot, and you activate an action that is associated with that building, and you get to do that action. Examples of these actions would be like immediately make another contribution anywhere else on the map, and you get to use cubes from your reserve instead of from your supply. Or score points based on how many cubes you have left in your supply. Or move two cubes directly from your reserve onto one of those colored spaces, scoring areas in the corners, right? So these are just examples of the actions. There are several of them. Jumping back a second to the third action that I talked about, I said that when you move your pawn from your architect from one building to another, a couple things happen. And that is that when you move off of a building, that building is considered to be completed. So all the cubes that are on that building in the contribution spots get moved immediately to the scoring area that matches the color of the disc. So if it's a yellow disc, all the cubes, regardless of who put them there, all those cubes go to the yellow scoring area. Then that disc flips over and becomes a building. And then the player whose architect had been there previously gets to place one of their little cardboard chits with stars on it on top of that building, and the number of stars equals the number of contributions that were made to the building. So if there were three contributions, you get three stars. You can also flip a building with no contributions. That is possible, and it happens. It's not ideal, but it can happen. In which case, it just flips over and no cubes go anywhere, and you don't get to place a cardboard chit down. The last thing to talk about is how do you actually score points in this game? So at the end of each century, which happens when a player either completely runs out of cubes or construction has begun on all of the buildings that were available in that century, then starting at the Citadel, which is the first scoring area, and then moving clockwise around the board to all the other colored areas in the corners, every player will score a point for every cube that they have in that area. So that part's simple. However, after that, and this is super important, the player or players with the most cubes in that area will move half of their cubes rounded down to the next area where they will score again. And we will do the same analysis of who has the most cubes there. Half of those will move to the next area and so on and so forth. So in this way, you can cascade points from one scoring area to the next. That process repeats until all five areas have been scored. And then we start over again. And the game ends after the fourth century. At this point, end game scoring, so those cardboard chits that you've been placing out onto each of these discs will score points based on the number of stars, as well as bonus points for each chit that you have that belongs to your largest connected area of chits. So it behooves you to make sure that as you're placing these buildings out and placing your architect that you are creating a continuous path. But that's also difficult because the buildings that are available to build on in any given round is randomized. So anyway, that is more or less how you play Quebec with a lot of rules left out.
Good job, Jason. That's hard to do.
I tried. So I think one of the interesting things that's maybe not immediately apparent just listening to the rules is that there's a lot of shared incentive stuff going on in this game. There's a lot of I need other people to build on my building so that I have contributions so that I can get, you know, the little star chits. Mm-hmm. And I want to contribute to other players' buildings so that I can activate actions and things like that. Let's talk a little bit about that. How did you guys feel about that? And how did that impact gameplay for you?
So I will say this is one of the most disorienting things that or feelings I've had in the game in a long time. If you put an architect on a building that's on a blob, there's an action associated with the blob.
Yeah, and you don't get to activate that action.
You don't get to activate that action if you contribute to it. And the dynamic there is you want people to contribute to your building, so you're incentivized to put it on a place where other people are going to do it. But you don't get to do it. So it is this whole...
And you're probably giving them a good action.
And you're giving them a good action. And so there's this really crazy sort of dichotomy of how you go about thinking about what your strategy is at the very beginning. And I will say your first few times when you play the game, probably all the way through, at least your first few turns, that feeling is absolutely disorienting as you go into the game of how do I pick a place that... I really want, but I am willing to give other people for, and then just hope they're going to do the thing that I want them to do. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it's just crazy.
I think there's... Go ahead.
Well, I will say, I think it's evolving complexity. Mm-hmm. So I do think that level of depth is there for sure. But if you are approaching this game, I mean, you can just place your architect wherever, right? And you may not be making the ideal decision, but the mechanics of it, at least for me, like going into it, like what do I do on my turn is pretty straightforward. It's like one of four things, right? Mm-hmm. And placing an architect is dead simple. When you start getting into what, the more you play it, the more it just becomes like this evolving complexity of like, okay, if I place here, that causes this to happen, that ripple effect. And I thought that was really cool. Like we talk about that a lot of like, the more you play a game, the more you see the depth of it. And
right.
I found that happening continuously playing this one.
This is very much a game where what you can do is easy. What you should do is right. very hard.
Yeah.
So I played this at multiple player counts, and I ended up teaching it a few times. And one of the things that I stressed as I taught it was that every cube is a point. Mm-hmm. So yes. Anytime that you're allowing somebody else to set a cube down, you're giving them a point. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of this tension that Bill's mentioning comes in, because you have to put your architect somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then the choice becomes, do I put it in a really good place where other people are going to come and use that space because they want to be there, which means they're going to get a point because every time they put a cube down, they get a point. Do I do that because the more they use my spot, then when I move my architect, I'll get more end game scoring because of the whole area control aspect. Mm-hmm. Or do I want to go somewhere where I don't want people to come to my spot because I don't want them to do cubes, but then maybe I never get to move my architect and I'm stuck.
Or you're forced to
contribute to my own and not get a bonus. And I think that tension, along with the cascading action that we'll get to in a moment, that's what makes this game, is where do you want to move your architect to, and then how do you score at the end? Because that all comes together.
Yeah, I wrote that down in my notes too. I think that is the game, is like, where do I move my architect? Well, maybe it's not the whole game, because there's also where do I contribute so that I get cubes in the right scoring areas. But I feel like that's like a critical action of this game, is like, where do I move my architect to?
Absolutely. Because truly, if you don't have a pretty big blob at the end of the game, you're not going to win, right? And if you don't manage the cascades, then you're not going to win. Or, I mean, to me, if you're not competitive in that big blob, loneliness.
I feel like there's also the inverse of, we've talked a lot about, like, where do I put my pawn so that other people contribute to me? But there's also that the flip side of that is, like, somebody else may have placed on a spot that's a really good action, and I'm like, I want to hit that action several times. But every time I do that, I'm giving them better endgame scoring, right? And so it's both sides of the coin. So you're constantly making that decision of like, well, oh man, like I could get three cubes out onto this space and activate that action, but I'm also like giving them more points, and I'm helping them like get a chit onto a space that's going to help them connect their two areas together or whatever, right?
One thing that's huge here that is getting things from your reserve to your supply, because it is really easy to not have chips to play onto the board. And one of the big ways to do that is moving your architect. So I don't know if it's super clear, but that is one of the biggest reasons why you have an incentive for other people to play on your architect, so that you can move it often enough so that you're getting chips moved from your reserve into the supply. There's other ways to do it. There's actions out there to get it, but sometimes those are hard to get. And so really you can find yourself contributing to your own architect, which isn't good that you don't get those actions, but simply so that you can get that income. It's tricky.
I think the mantra for me at some point of realizing that a cube is a point. I realize that sounds very, very simple, and you all may have got that on the very first game, but it took me just a little bit to click, because I kept thinking, what is the best spot to go to? Mm-hmm. How do I make sure my people move into the right zone, the purple zone or the yellow zone? And for me, realizing even if I get anywhere on the board, a cube is a point. Mm-hmm. It's at least 1 point. Yeah. And right. It can be a lot more.
Right. Yeah. So maybe we should transition in talking about the cascade. Because like you're saying, it can be 1 point. But once it transitions to the outside four corners and it goes through that cascade, there's a lot of math going on in your head about, okay, who's where? Where do I put it? And you know, you may do something that is less efficient out on the board on your actions so that it gives you a lead on a corner color board. So
this hopefully won't be too complex for people to hear as we go through. So this cascade action is super interesting. So if you have the majority in a zone, then half of your pieces will move down to the next zone, actually a max of five, but up to five can move on to the next zone. And so at one level, this math is pretty easy, that if you know you're going to cascade, then it's one for the first one. It's a half for the next. If they can cascade again, it'll be a quarter. If they can cascade again, it'll be an eighth. Mm-hmm. But the math isn't that easy, because maybe when you cascade, that's what gives you the majority in the next section. Mm-hmm. So those will cascade with you as well. Yep. And I think that math is what makes the game super tricky about how do I make sure that I can continue to cascade and I don't just get stopped on the next one. Or if you're playing defensively, how do I make sure that I put enough cubes in this second area that people will move into to stop them from cascading? And that was a super interesting bit of the game, I thought.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen this type of mechanism for scoring in any other game, and it's really pretty clever. I think if you manage to get at least one level of cascading in, you're doing pretty good. But if you can really chain it together and get several levels going, that feels really good to be able to make that work.
It might be a good time now to talk a little bit about those cards, because those cards can change that. There's a card at the top that'll allow you to...
You're talking about the special roll cards.
The special roll cards, yeah.
Clarify.
Special roll cards. There's a card that'll allow you to, whenever you're transitioning from your architect to the corners, to change which color you're moving it to, which can be super powerful. There's another one that will allow you to contribute to your own architect city, which, you know, certainly early in the game can also be super powerful.
And still get the action.
And just to clarify Bill's first one there, you can always move your architect wherever you want to move your architect to, but the cubes will always go into the zone color. That's the color of the little circle that you're on.
Right.
And if you have that one, you can choose where they go to, which means that you can stuff a lot, perhaps, in a certain zone to make sure that they're going to cascade down. And that, that's one, by the way, to make sure you play the rules correctly and you only cascade the right number down.
Yeah, we did screw that up a little bit.
I played one game where somebody used that to move all 21 of their cubes into the same zone, which then allowed them to cascade
down.
Basically through every zone. It broke the game. The game was still incredibly interesting, and I think most of the strategy still applies, but don't do that. That'd be a mistake.
Right. Yeah, that's why that rule exists. Makes it way more interesting, I think. Yeah, and we didn't even talk about event cards. So there are also randomized event cards that one event card drawn out of a random deck applies to each century, and these add in additional, like, first person to connect three blue cities together gets scores points, or like some other rule that affects gameplay for each century.
And those are explicitly optional in the rules,
yeah,
right?
They are optional. That's like advanced play, but I think it's a reasonably like minor addition that adds some you know, diversity to each play, right?
So one thing I thought was cool that you asked about shared incentives at the beginning. In many ways, this is a game of perfect knowledge. Everything is open information on the entire game. You can see what everyone else is going to do, but it is not a game where you can start at the beginning and say, "Here's what I'm going to do in the next six turns."
Yep.
Because what I need to do is going to be determined by what you just did. You have to pay attention to what other people are doing. I think you have to pay attention to where their eyes are focusing. Like, where do they think they might want to go next? What does it look like they're trying to do from an area control perspective?
Yep.
If I'm in Century 1, what are the Century 2 tokens? And what does that mean about how Bill might want to be connecting for area control in the next area? Can I let him, like, can I put cubes on him right now, which will give him a chit for the next round, or not? And I thought that level of interaction was really interesting.
I thought it was really clever how they split up the available buildings by century, because everything is randomized. So that means in the first round, at best, like you can't start creating a blob in the first round. It's a bunch of islands, basically.
Right.
All the buildings are kind of spaced out because they're all randomized throughout this map. But you're looking at all the twos, like, where are all the twos? Okay. Which of the twos helps me get closer to being able to connect my islands together?
Right. Do I have to get? Mm-hmm.
You have to throw the word out, right? They look like, if you look at the board, it looks like fidget spinners. And every person I played the game with was like, oh, look, there's fidget spinners all over the board. Because those areas, those blobs we're talking about, they look exactly like a fidget spinner.
They do look like large fidget spinners. Mm-hmm. It's true. Which I guess takes us to a potential con. I've seen opinions both ways on this. But looking at the board for this game, it's like a giant pinata exploded all over the board, I think. There's so many colors because they needed the four colors of the different areas to be different from the player colors. So until you take five different player colors that are all very bright, add to that four board colors that are all randomized and mixed together and layered on top of each other... It's just like this giant blob of, like...
It's fireworks.
And even with that, I don't think they managed to avoid overlap, because I'm pretty sure there's yellow areas on the board, and I usually play as yellow, and I was able to still play as yellow. And so there's still some visual confusion at times because those colors don't perfectly overlap.
Yeah.
or they do overlap. They don't perfectly not overlap.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it can visually be a little difficult to process at times. But the board, fortunately, is very large. And so at the very least, like they, it's not like tiny little circles that you're trying to look at. Mm-hmm.
So are we transitioning into dislikes? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, do we have anything else that we want to tease out of the
I'll throw one more positive in just related to the board. I thought this was nice in the fact that it's a big board, mm-hmm. but it doesn't take up a lot of table space in that pretty much everything that you need is on the board. There's not a giant area surrounding it with cards or minis or so forth. Mm-hmm. In a world where for so many games, more means better, more means better, this is a pretty simple game in mm-hmm. terms of components and what you need to play, but deceptively complex for what you get out of just those small pieces.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All right. Well, yeah, I think it's safe to transition over to cons. Does anybody have any other cons that stood out to them?
I'll say that the last round can sometimes, can feel like it doesn't play out like the others because people are trying to close out the area majority kind of things. Exactly. And so if you're expecting people to contribute to your architect in the same way and try to score points in that method, it's almost like a different game that last round. That oftentimes, or and if the games that I played, people would put their architect down and didn't even have to contribute to their own because everybody was kind of trying to do that so they can complete their area control. And so that it wasn't the same kind of scoring. So if you're expecting that, then that's just not what happens. And I don't necessarily call that a con other than it. I wonder if it just plays out that way in every game kind of thing.
I will say if I had one con, it would be that it doesn't feel, if you do any bit of planning ahead, it doesn't feel super difficult to complete your largest area. Like it felt like most of the time, mm-hmm. most people were completing their area. And I think that could be because we weren't playing as viciously as we could and like trying to block by like moving an architect into a spot that somebody else needed. But it felt like even the times when I thought about doing that, the cost to me to do that to someone else was higher than the potential risk.
Absolutely.
Because there are so many ways to connect your areas together that it felt like, well, I could go there and steal that spot from Bill, but he can just go around the other direction,
right,
and very easily still connect his area together. So it would be like you would almost have to team up against somebody to try to prevent them from doing that. Mm-hmm. And even then, it's really only in like the fourth round, because up until that point, there's only so much blocking you can do, right? Because the pathways are still available and haven't been.
So that's very interesting. Yet, right? So I played once with you all and then played with another group a few times. So I played this at 2, 3, and 4 players. Mm-hmm. And the group without you, we were much more aggressive in area control. We were actively trying to stomp people's area control in both of those games.
Was that a 3-player game?
Both in the 3-player and the 2-player.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I wonder if at lower player counts it becomes more of a thing because you have more area to spread out and there's more opportunities to try to cut off sections of that.
Right, and I think that's what was happening is we had blobs, but there was very clear opportunities for somebody to try to connect two sides of the board. Mm-hmm. And so there was some very aggressive, I'm going to stop you from creating that channel that goes across the center of the board to connect your two halves sort of thing.
Yeah.
In the vein of a game that may change in back to the 2, 3, 4 player sort of thing, it is a different game at 2 players. I enjoyed it at 2 players, but a 2 player variant brings in a neutral party that you have some control over. The way that ends up working, I think, is whoever completes the area of the architect with the neutral player is the one who gets to score it. And so then you end up with this very tight tension. Nobody wants to be the person who puts the second set of cubes onto something because somebody else will always be the third one. So there's this game of chicken that develops, and it's a different game with two. Huh. I did not think it was a bad game, but it was a different game.
Interesting.
Another potential con, game times ranged from 1 hour to 3 hours. depending on the AP of the players. So this is a very, very possible AP game in order to push it all the way from 1 to 3 hours.
That's true.
Okay.
One more negative?
One more negative. Yep. Throw it out there.
The leader cards, I think Bill disagrees with me. I think they are wildly not equal to one another. I think the political leader that allows you to move all of your cubes to a given location is just in a totally different class than the one that allows you to pick up three and only three and move them to the Citadel.
Yeah. There are five, right?
There are five. But
you would never have to use that one if you don't.
Yeah, I will say the Citadel one does feel a little underwhelming. I think the reason why it's in there is because the Citadel is always the first location to cascade down. But it feels very difficult to get cubes into the Citadel any other way. So it seemed like there wasn't a whole lot of competition for that most of the time because people just focused on the other four. And maybe there is a way to play it such that that becomes more of a contender and you can wreak havoc there. I wonder if the move all your cubes to a different area thing is as much of an issue with the rules correction that we realized that we made a mistake on, right? Because at that point, like, yeah, your level of control is the level of control is still there, and that's important, but you're not able to just like pile everything in the same area. And
it is absolutely less of an issue with the right rules. I'm still convinced it is an issue.
Yeah,
but I think this is one where another 10 plays would tell me yes or no.
Yeah, I wonder if the other ones, aside from the Citadel one, which I struggle with a little bit, the other ones I feel like have their opportunities for being awesome. Like the one that scores you points every time you move your architect, like that can be huge. Also, I think who was it? Bill, maybe?
No, I think it's Chris.
Chris, yeah, was scoring tons of points off of that,
right?
Because he planned to. I'm not gonna like wait for a ton of investment here. I'm just gonna move my architect a lot, and every time I move my architect, I score points.
Right.
So I think used in the right way, they all feel powerful, but I feel like we did see that particular one that you mentioned used to great effect many times. So yeah, it would be interesting to see how it played out over more plays. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Ken, I think you're up this time around to round us out for final thoughts. So
all right. Well, when we finished our first game of this, I went home, and before I went to bed, I sent out 4 or 5 BGG trade requests trying to obtain a copy. I knew when I went home that I wanted it, and I didn't get one. I think I'm glad, because the more I have played it, the less enamored I am with getting a copy of it. It's still in my wish list, and I want one, but I think if I don't get one, I'm going to be happy. I think that's because at the beginning, I really liked the player interactions. And I was thinking that the way that you can lay the pieces out at the beginning of the game would give it a lot of variety from game to game. More I've played it, though, I think I began at an easy 5. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm down maybe to a 4. I've gone back and forth. Tomorrow morning, I may be back at a 5. I've really struggled with whether I'd call this a 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it. But I'm concerned about long-term replayability. I wish there were more variables to mess with. I wish there were more leader cards to give you a few more options to choose from. I wish there were maybe some different tiles to replace the beginning of the fidget spinners. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal, but I do wish that there was that. I'm still concerned that the leader cards that they have aren't particularly balanced. And because I play so many games at 2-player, I thought it was a good game at 2-player. I didn't think it was a great game at 2-player, and that's where I play the majority of my games. Gotcha. So I can see this being a 6 in some people's lists. I will be shocked if it's not a 5 for both of you, but for me, I think in the end it's probably a 4, for at least for now.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah. All right, I'll go. I will say, again, when I played this game the first time, I was absolutely disoriented my first few moves because the whole, counterintuitive plays of helping somebody else out on the play that didn't even feel like shared incentives in a way. It just felt like I'm just giving you stuff and, you know, why are you going to give me stuff until you kind of figured it out, that really how it played out. And it took at least, 3 or 4 rounds to play it. I will also say that I'm have a little bit of a glow effect because I ended up winning the games that I played. So I had that side of it. So take what I say with a grain of salt, maybe if it airs too much on the positive side. But I don't know. I really enjoyed this game. There's just so many things on this to think about. I think the rules are pretty straightforward when you're actually in the room and you can see the board. So I'm not sure how much you guys are picking up with a podcast description. But again, to play the part of Chris, I felt like a lot of my turns were painful, right? I was like, how am I gonna decide exactly what I'm gonna play? And it is an AP prone game, but I'm gonna give it a 5 because it was, like Ken said, it's hard not to, just because it's tight, it's elegant, it's, I don't know, there's a lot going on in it. So anyway, it's very cool.
Nice. Yeah, I hate to fall into my stereotype role on this show, but Ken, you mentioned that this is like a perfect information game. I feel like this is just the type of game that's in my wheelhouse. I really enjoy both area control and worker placement as mechanisms in games, and so the combination of those two things together, adding in shared incentives on top of all of that, just the level of variability that is here really impressed me. I enjoyed my plays of this one a lot, even though we played it incorrectly. I don't know that we cascaded above 5 a ton, but it definitely impacts the way you think about the game. And so I'm curious to play it more. I was between a 5 and a 6. I think I settled on a 5 for this one. There's just something that keeps it out of that top ranking for me, but I am absolutely wanting to play this some more. And hopefully we'll get a chance to do that with some things I'm going to talk about here in a second. When we get into availability. But I guess I wrapped this up, so I guess we're at that point.
We
right?
are.
So I'm giving this a 5 for now. If Quebec interests you, it is not currently available from Noble Knight. And any copies that are out there, Ken probably already would have snapped up like a couple weeks ago when he was looking. But there are 10 copies available on BGG for around $30. However,
really?
As I was looking up information about this game, I noticed a post by our own friend Ghidorah in the forum for Quebec talking about a potential reprint of this game by Spielworks sometime this year. Now, I tried to do a little digging on this, and maybe Ghidorah has more information about this that he can share in the BGG Guild. But I tried to do a little bit of digging on Spielworks' website. I don't see any mention of anything out of them of this being pending or coming. So hopefully that is in the works, and hopefully if they do reprint it, maybe they can add in some additional roll cards or vary out the different actions that are in the fidget spinners, and hopefully make the board a little bit more, a little less pinata-like. But yeah, so keep an eye out for that. It's a potential reprint. I say potential because I don't have a confirmed source of it other than Ghidorah's post, which he, to be fair, did take from Heavy Cardboard, and I think that came from more informed sources than we have. But yeah, so that's a possibility out there. So if it interests you, keep an eye out or pick up one of the copies off of BGG.
And those are our thoughts on Quebec.
Nice.
I think we may have to rename this from Jason's Shelf of Shame to Jason's Shelf of, hey, those are really pretty good.
Yeah, that's right. Vindication. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of Hidden Gems. If you like what we're doing here, please remember it's a huge help to us if you leave a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice and or follow us on our various social media platforms. Those simple things can make a big difference for the show's exposure so that more folks can enjoy exploring games with us. Check out the BGG Guild if you want to interact with us or share a game that you feel is a hidden gem. And if you're so inclined, please consider supporting the show over at patreon.com/hiddengemspodcast. Where you can access and listen to all of our backstage extra content. Until next time, I'm your host, Jason.
This is Ken.
And this is Bill.
Thanks for listening.
This episode of Hidden Gems, number 62, was recorded in Raleigh, North Carolina on April 21st, 2024. Join us again in 3 weeks when we review a trio of games from Asian designers. Hidden Gems is produced and edited by Chris Alley, Cameron Lockie, and Jason Yonsoff. A Board Game Geek Guild is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Ghidorah. Our Discord is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Snoozefest. Our Hidden Gems logo was designed by artist Kate Nieto. Check out her work on Instagram at @iskatenieto. Thank you for joining us on this Hidden Gems episode. Until next time, fellow gem seekers, enjoy your games and enjoy your search.